I'm an alcoholic. My name is Diz Titcher.
Hey, Diz.
My sobriety date is May 5th, 1981. My home group is the Mustard Seed Group in Tallahassee, Florida. It's one of the best two meetings in the whole world. And my sponsor is a man by the name of Tommy Hicks. Tommy's from Crawfordville, Florida, and he's not doing too good. He don't get out that much anymore, but he and I still try to get together every now and then. It's really good to come back to Dothan. My wife reminded me before I left, this was the seventh time that I've been invited over here to speak. And I said, seven times? Wow, I feel like a newcomer to this group. It's always good to come in and see Miss Ida. That's the first one I'm going to acknowledge. And then her husband back there, you know, Nate and Don and Mr. Walter and everybody else. And then I got my friends from Montgomery, got Miss Peggy, and I got Amanda. Amanda's my girlfriend. She and I share an awful lot out of this book, and she's very inquisitive. She asks a lot of questions. But I want to thank Mama Jean and I started talking about this big book workshop about 2 years ago. And we finally got it down that we're going to do something tomorrow. And then she's talking about maybe doing something bigger later on. And she told me that Nikki was going to be in charge. And I about made her crazy on the internet, send her different things of what we was going to do and everything else. But I just love to come and talk about AA and the big book. That's my life. I don't talk about the 12 and 12 or any of those other books because to me it's not that important. If it's not in this book, then it's not worth repeating. I checked on birthdays, Tammy and Jeremy. And the first birthday that I could find that was recorded was in Chicago in 1947. And two sponsors wanted to celebrate their sponsor's birthday. And he was against it. He didn't want to do it because he didn't think anybody in this fellowship should be put on a pedestal. And finally he relented and said, okay, I'll do it for one reason. And that reason is to show the rest of you that this program works. That's the reason we have birthdays. No other reason. And that's what makes this fellowship tick. I don't care whether you have 1 year, 15 years, 31 years, you know. You're a member of this fellowship, and you got here the hard way, I think. Most of us did anyway. I go out in an awful lot of places to enjoy this fellowship, and I was a traveling salesman for years, and one of the places I traveled and liked was Louisville, Kentucky. And I'd go in the intergroup office there, and there was a lady by the name of Helen. And Helen would always send me to a lot of good meetings and send me across the river to New Albany, Indiana, and send me all over Louisville to go to them. I spent a lot of time there. And so I was went in and thanked her for one of the meetings, and she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to work my way back home. And she said, which way you go? And I said, I don't go any certain way. I'll just go any way I can find a way to get home. And she said, Diz, why don't you go down to Bardstown? And I said, all right. What am I going to do there? And she gave me the address, and she said, there's a museum there. And she said, I think you ought to go in and look at that museum. And I said, okay, Helen, thank you very much. And so I did. I went to Bardstown, and I found this nice-looking house and museum, and I went in, and I was browsing around and looking at everything, and all of a sudden, I came up on this letter, and I asked the lady, I said, is there any way that I get a copy of this letter? And she said, yeah. She said, I'll be glad to make you a copy of it. She took it out of the case and made a copy and gave it to me, and I'm going to read it to you. And it said, this letter was written by one friend to another describing the last few days on earth of this very talented man. January the 10th, 1864, New York City. Dear Jerry, early one Monday morning, I received a message saying that our friend had met with an accident. I dressed hurriedly and went to number 15 on the Bowery in the lowest part of the city to that old vermin-infested rooming house where Steve lived. I found him lying on the floor in the hall, blood oozing from a cut in his throat, which he had sliced himself, and a bad bruise on his forehead where he had fallen. Steve lay there on the floor, naked and suffering horribly. I found he had a wonderful big brown eyes, as you will recall, and when he looked up and begged me for a drink. I was going to get him one, but before I could get it, a doctor who had been sent for arrived and forbidden me to do so. I decided that the doctor was not a very good one, and I went to the bar and got Steve a big drink of rum, which I gave him, and it seemed to help him a lot. All the time I was caring for him, he seemed terribly weak, and his eyelids kept fluttering. Then he started screaming and crying and fighting off imaginary things he was seeing. I shall never forget it. I called the police wagon and took him to Bellevue Hospital. I registered him as a laborer and a charity patient. What a terrible come down for a man who had once been as famous as Steve had been. I went back to the hospital the following day to see him. When he was rational, he told me he had nothing was done for him and that he was dying. He kept begging me for rum all the time. When I went back again the next day to see him, they told me, "Your friend is dead." They had sent his body down into the morgue, and I went down in the gloomy morgue, and there was an old man sitting there smoking. I told him what I wanted, and he said, "Look for him over there," pointing away with his pipe stem. He showed me to a row of dirty pine boxes. I went around peering into boxes till I found Steve's body. It was taken care of by an undertaker and removed from Bellevue Hospital. The next day, his brother, Morrison, and Steve's widow arrived. And when Jeannie entered the room where her husband's body was lying, she fell on her knees beside him and remained there weeping for a long time. Now, I know all of you might have surmised that this man who died so miserably in that cold, dismal winter day was Stephen Collins Foster, the greatest songwriter our country has ever known. He is often referred to as America's troubadour. His talent and genius had never been equaled and will never be surpassed. Every one of us here has played or sung his songs. He has attained international fame and is in the only musician in America's Hall of Fame. Who but an inspired genius could have written "My Old Kentucky Home," "Old Susanna," "The Old Folks at Home," and "Way Down Upon the Suwannee River," and the words and music to 180 songs? Stephen Foster died in this alcoholic hell when he was only 38 years old. He had married at 20, had two children, both girls, but his drinking had driven his family away from him after only 5 years of married life. He always longed for his wife and children, and he wrote America's most beautiful ballad, "I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair." He wrote it as a gift to his wife, but instead he sold it for a few pitiful dollars to satisfy his mad desire for alcohol. Mrs. Foster never heard this song until some years after Steve's death, and as his wonderful music and beautiful words fell upon her ears for the first time, she burst in tears, because she knew that this was her husband's undying tribute of love that he had for her. This man made a fortune for himself and others. His songs were bringing happiness to millions. He had the praise of the entire world for his talent, yet he died with only two personal possessions, 38 cents, one for each year of his life, and the other thing in his possession was a slip of paper bearing these words, "Dear friends and gentle hearts." This was undoubtedly the thing for the song that today remains unwritten and unsung. Stephen Foster died leaving America a rich heritage of song. It is beyond the realm of speculation what this heritage could have meant had he lived a normal life, unshackled by alcohol. How fortunate are we to live in this more enlightened area, we who suffer from the same incurable disease that so horribly killed this beloved American, can now find a solution to all our problems. How arrogant and egotistical would I be tonight if I could succeed against this killer that has ruined much better men than I? If men such as Stephen Foster and thousands of other men of exceptional ability died as a result of alcoholism, wouldn't I be mighty stupid to say I could concede on my own efforts where they fail? I did that for a reason, because I was talking to Amanda earlier about how much time does she spend meditating. And I mean meditating and reminiscing and thinking about a lot of times these people who took time to pass this program down to us. I do that. I do that about every 2 weeks. And my recollection is pretty good, because I know a bunch of people. I probably know over 50,000 people that I have met in this fellowship. And a lot of them are not around today. A lot of them passed this program on to me. And I'm dearly, dearly indebted to them. And that's why I do what I do. I'll go anywhere, anytime, to talk about this fellowship, and especially this book. This letter scared the hell out of me. And it frightened me, because I didn't know whether I was really doing enough to keep Diz sober and in recovery. You know, I wanted a better life more than anybody else in the whole world. And I was going to do just about anything I possibly could to ensure myself that I was going to have that life. I study this book. I don't read it. I read the newspaper and read magazines, but I study this book because it's a textbook. And it's got the information in there for me to get in recovery and stay in recovery. The one line that after I read this letter, the one line that popped out of me in this book was, continue to grow along spiritual lines. I think that is so pronounced in this fellowship, and that's going to be the theme of what I'm going to talk about tonight, and that's going to be spirituality. When you open this book, the first place you'll find it talked about is Dr. Bob. It's in the foreword to the second edition. It said, this physician, which is Dr. Bob, had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. Bill's writing this, and he talks about Dr. Bob working a spiritual program, but he was in the Oxford group. And the Oxford group was not a spiritual program. It was a religious program. It was the teachings of Jesus Christ. And they talked about first century Christianity. So what he did, he really tried religion and it failed. You know, and let me tell you this right now, because I might forget to say it. It just popped in my mind. We are born in religion. We're born Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, Episcopalian. That's a tough one, isn't it? But let me tell you, spirituality you have to work for, and it's God-given. So that's why I like to talk about. So Dr. Bob met this broker named Bill Wilson, who talked about Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness. Then the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. You see, when he met Bill Wilson, Bill Wilson then go to him and say, now look, Dr. Bob, this is what you ought to do. And Dr. Bob, you must go do this. You must do this. He didn't do that. Bill Wilson sat there and said, you know, when I drink, I get drunk. And usually I go out and I show my ass. And he started talking about himself. And Dr. Bob's sitting here. He don't know what's going on. And all the times they talked for something like over 6 hours. And Dr. Bob said, this is one man that knows exactly what he's talking about to help somebody in the recovery. Spiritual program. The next one I found is very important. I like to talk about it. It says, in Bill's story, it says, I was soon, on page 8, if you're following me, I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to be called the fourth dimension of existence. Now, if you study this book, you find out in the fourth step, that the two things they talk about is physical and mental. And if you talk about the 8 problems of alcoholics in step 1, you find out we couldn't control our emotional nature. So the 3 existence that we live in is physical, mental, and emotional. And it says, now, I'm going to be catapulted in the fourth dimension of existence, spirituality. You know, Now, how am I going to be spiritual? Well, if you look at that word, you'll find the word ritual. You know, and ritual means you do something daily. Not weekly or monthly, daily. And there's about seven things you must do in order to be ritualistic. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Study this book. Work the steps in your life. Pray and meditate. Get a sponsor. And help others. And you continue to do those on a daily basis. Then you're going to have a pretty good life. So I'm going to be catapulted in the fourth dimension of existence. What is it? I was to know happiness, peace, and a usefulness and a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Tells you what you're going to do, and it gives you the answer to you right in the next page. Next one I found is Bill Wilson again. Bill's story. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. That's a warning. And, you know, regardless of how hard we work with people, we're still going to have low spots and high spots in our life. We just hope the low spots don't take us down. Next one, page 25. I love this. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem has been solved, sponsors. You heard them talk, get up here and talk about Tammy and Jeremy. These are the people that you listen to. There was nothing left for us to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools that laid at our feet. Everybody asked me, what's your spiritual tool? So what I did, I went and got one of these lunch boxes. And I put in a lunch box, I put the big book. I put the 12 and 12. I put the 24-hour book, which is really not a conference-approved literature, but I put it in there because it's about prayers. And I put in a where and when. And that's a kit of spiritual tools. And they really lay at our feet. Pick them up and use them. And you'll be all right. Here's what it says. Again, we have found much of heaven. And we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, for we have not ever even dreamed. Catapulted the first time, now we've been rocketed. And that's all because of the work that we've done in between these two things for the first 25 pages. But here's the thing about it. It talks about a great fact. There's about four or five facts in this book, but this is a great fact. It's just this and nothing else, that we have had a deep and effective spiritual experience. We have had it. Everybody in this room has had a spiritual experience. If you haven't, what the hell are you doing here? I don't care how big it is or small it is or anything else. You've had it. Something made you come to fellowship, come to the alcoholic, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Something made you do it. That's that little hand of God. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, too. All right. Now, this spiritual experience has revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. Those three things are the steps. The steps deal with me, deal with you, and deal with my relationship with the higher power. And so that's how it revolutionized our whole life, by having this spiritual experience. And the central fact of our life today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered in our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. Isn't that amazing? We stumble around for years. I heard a tape the other day where Ken Devaney, one of my favorite speakers, was talking about he had a son that died of AIDS. And in his last four or five days of his life, in order to go to the bathroom, he had to crawl on the floor to get to the bathroom. And he did that to retain his dignity. And Ken said, how many times was I crawling around losing my dignity? That's what we do. If you are a serious alcoholic, as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life had become impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other, to accept spiritual help. Simple. Two choices. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with this doctor. This is a man by the name, Roland Hazard. He had a drinking problem that he just wouldn't come home. And he'd get down in New York City and just go on the Bowery and drinking sprees and everything else. And his wife and brother would have to come down and get him. He lived in Peacedale, Rhode Island. And finally, he got so daggone bad, they said, well, we're just going to have to send you to a psychiatrist. And they wanted to send him to Sigmund Freud. But Sigmund Freud had cancer at that time, wasn't taking any new patients. They wanted to send him to Albert Adler, who was the number one psychiatrist in the United States. And he didn't have any openings. He wouldn't take him. So they found a guy named Carl Jung over in Switzerland. They sent him over there. And so the doctor's talking to him. He said, you had the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Says our friend felt as if the gates of hell had closed on him. He said to the doctor, is there no exceptions? Now, this is a psychiatrist. Usually they don't break out of their realm at all, but he did. He went out and he said, yes. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Listen to this. Ideas, emotions, and attitude, which were one of the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set put in its place. Roland Hazard got the message from Carl Jung and brought it back and gave it to Ebbie Thacker. Ebbie Thacker gave it to Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson gave it to Dr. Bob. Page 28 says, in the following chapters, there's appeared an explanation of alcoholism. Oh, as we understand it. Then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many who were once in this class are now among our members. Agnostics are among our members. Surprising enough, we find such conviction no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. That's all they're talking about is a solution to alcoholism. Page 35. This is one of my favorites. I got a lot of information in this story. It's about a guy named Jim. And it says, our first example is a friend we should call Jim. This man had a charming wife and family. Anybody fit that bill? He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into our contact. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. He made a beginning. He took step one and two. His family was reassembled and began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. He didn't do 3 through 12. He stopped. He got well. And he felt like, I got it now. Self-will. To his consternation, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we work with him. If you ever want to know how many times you're supposed to work with an alcoholic, your answer is right here. Because that means 7 times that they work with him. And when you turn the page, you find out he got drunk again. And he came back and we talked to him one more time. So there's 8 times. So if you want to know how many times you have to work with an alcoholic, the answer is 8, because it's in the book. I said, trying to explain to earlier to Amanda, you know, that one of the old timers, when I first came in, told me that this fellowship was divided in 3 different sections. The first section is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which you can find in this book from the Roman numerals up to page 181. You heard me, but it's 181, not 164, 181. The second section is experiences. Experiences of the stories in the big book. Dr. Bob and the good old timers, the 12 and 12, AA comes of age, etc. And the third section is opinions. And believe me, they got a lot of opinions around this fellowship. Some of these gurus that, oh my heavens, well, I don't want to go there. But anyway, so there's you got the information how many times you're supposed to work with an alcoholic. And then it goes on to the next time, they're talking about this Fred, who's another guy that drinking was lost his job. And he came in contact with us, and he says, far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. If you're an alcoholic, you're going to suffer from depression. You understand that? Scientifically, alcohol is a depressant. So you're going to suffer from it whether you want to or not. It's going to get you, right, nursing students? Thank you very much. She told me you was over here. He made his mind to quit altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. I don't know where self-will takes you, because it didn't take me anywhere, because when I came in, I believed that the solution for me was to accept the spiritual way of life. And it didn't take me very long. I didn't have any belief in any kind of God. I really didn't think God liked me. And when I look at my past behavior, I say, well, it's probably the reason he don't like me. But I went through the process. I did steps 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I did them as best I possibly could. I didn't leave out one single thing. And when I took my 5th step, I had God on my resentment list. And when I started talking about to the person just in my 5th step, and he looked at me and he said, "Why are you angry at God for?" And his name was Clarence, and I said, "Clarence," I said, "God don't like me." Clarence had 29 years. And he looked at me and he said, "Diz, you're not big enough for God to dislike." Think about that. That'd drop you down a little bit, wouldn't it? took my sails out of me, I'll tell you that. But anyway, go up to page 42 and they're talking about this, these AA and everything else, talking to Fred, and he said, then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action which Chandra to them had followed successfully. Today, 48 million people have gone through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. 48 million. Though it had been only a nominal church man, their proposal was not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with this process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. It doesn't say it will help you solve your problems. It says it will solve all your problems. How can I live a spiritual life? Don't drink. Go to meetings. Get a sponsor. Study the big book. Work the steps in your life. Pray and meditate and help others. Is that too hard to do? Well, some of us don't do it very well. Step two is, it says lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power which we live. It had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how will we define this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is all about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. There it is again. It says to us twice. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. So they're going to get into a few moral issues in this book. And it means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. Here, difficulty arises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God, for we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly invaded or ignored. There's a lot more things in this book that talks about spirituality and living a spiritual program. But the one that really jumps out on me is on page 83, and it says, the spiritual life is not a theory. A theory is nothing but an idea that has the best idea at the time. It puts out all other ideas you have in your mind. That's what a theory is. It says we have to live it. Unless one family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than words. Our behavior will convince them more than words. So the way we live is the best way to show somebody how this program, and that's another thing, shows them how we work. One of the things I love, another sentence in this book is on page 28. I got it underlined 15 times. It says, what seemed at first a flimsy reed had proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. If you want to know what kept you afloat all those daggone years, you might call it a flimsy reed. But it was your God, as you understand Him, was reaching out to you even then. And thank God He rescued me. I'm positive that He just looked down from His pearly gates up there and said, my God, Diz is doing terrible. He says, I got to stop and put him over here. And that's what He did. I've had a lot of wonderful times in my life. I was telling Stan a story about my first sponsee that I ever got. That I gave a talk when I was about 2.5 months sober, 2.5 years sober, excuse me, on a Wednesday night in Greensboro, North Carolina. And after the talk, you know how people come up and thank you for your talk and congratulate and all that. And all of a sudden, this little girl about 5 foot tall with a baseball cap came up. And she said, I can identify with a lot of things that you said. And she said, I wondered if you would be my sponsor. And I said, let me think about that. Give me your name and number and I'll get back to you. I didn't know the full procedures. So my sponsor, well, I couldn't call him that late at night, so I waited until the next day and I called him and told him what had happened. He said, well, come over. And I went over to his house and he got out his book and he said, I want you to turn to page 60 and I want you to read that 12th step to me. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. He said, whoa, read that last line to me. So we try to carry this message to alcoholics. He said, read that to me one more time. He said, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. It says, do you understand what that says? And I said, I don't know whether I really, truly understand what it says. It says, it don't say in there that you carry this meat to men only, does it? It don't say in there that women go to women. And it says you carry the message to alcoholics. And he said, the day you can't do that, you get your ass out of this fellowship because we don't want you. I called that little girl up and I said, I'd be honored to be your sponsor. And I've worked with her. I found a place at a park in Greensboro, General Green Park, where we could sit at a picnic table. And I took her through this big book, Spoonful at a Time, because that's the way it was given to me. About 3 years ago, Christmas time, came in the mail, we got a card, and my wife looked at it and said, "Hey, it's from Sue." So, I opened it up. Nice card there. Wishing Nancy and I, it's my wife, a very happy Christmas and joyful season. And then there was a letter in there. And I pulled the letter out, and she said, "Dear Diz," she said, "the other day I wanted to go into the big city to do some Christmas shopping. Instead of going down to the interstate, I went down the back way." And she said, "As I was going through the back way into the city, I passed that General Green Park." And she said, "I looked over and saw that picnic table still by that tree where we used to sit." And she said, "I got out of my car and I went over to sit down at that picnic table. And I reminisced about all the things that we had done and all those times that we met in that park." And she said, "Today I want you to know that I've been sober 27 years. And she said, "I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "I love you very much. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Diz Tischer. Thank you very much."
I appreciate it. Okay. The big book group has a monthly business meeting on the fourth Tuesday of every month. If you are interested in joining our group, please feel free to attend. Forgot to read that, I think. Diz, thank you. Thank you so much. Y'all come back tomorrow and he'll finish this deal.
Bring your big book tomorrow.
Bring your big book.
If you think I learn something tonight, wait until tomorrow. Because I'm going to ask questions.
I want my money back already. But Nate, you going to do the chips?
Hey, Nate.
Congratulations to the birthday show. Keep doing what you're doing. Tammy, you can sponsor Doug, you might get better. We had the chips just in the like folks, that's why I think that's just